sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture. They're telling you that you will never see the horror. Spend it all today and we will bill you tomorrow. And bank accounts in Bahamas. Wall Street crime will never send you to the slammer. Tell all the children in the arms of the mamas, the F-15 is a homicide bomber. TV commercial for a popper pill culture. Drug companies circling like a vulture. Amaraki babies with the G.I. Joe father. 10 years from now, is anybody gonna bother? Yeah, fire. Never come with a warning, a revolution. Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same green. From the banks of the river to the banks of the greedy. All of the riches taken back by the needy. We come from the country and we come from the city. Play us on a record, you can play us on a CD. All the shit you've given us is fertilizer. The seeds that you planted, you can never brutalize.
And that was Yell Fire by Michael Franti and Spearhead. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 105. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Mark Passio titled Mind Control Part 1 and is being released on Monday, February 28, 2011. My interview with Mark was recorded on February 26, 2011. Mark Passio is an independent researcher, public speaker, and radio talk show host from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mark has undertaken the task of assembling vast amounts of research in areas of metaphysics, occultism, spirituality, symbolism, and consciousness studies. In 2007, Mark began presenting his information in the form of a unique presentation and lecture series entitled What on Earth is Happening? With the intention of bringing the implications of this body of knowledge to the greater public awareness. In 2010, Mark began hosting his own weekly radio talk show, also called What on Earth is Happening, which is carried live every Tuesday evening on the Revolution Broadcast Network. At the Free Your Mind 2011 conference, Mark will be giving a presentation on occult symbolism used in police and military uniforms and regalia, and the specific modes of consciousness which this type of subversive symbolism is deliberately used to elicit from those within these institutions. And just a note, I will also be speaking at the Free Your Mind Conference in Philadelphia in April, and that's going to be Saturday and Sunday, April 9th and 10th. And you can find out more about that at www.freeyourmindconference.com. And you can also find out more about Mark's research at www.whatonearthishappening.com. Donations this week, my love and thanks goes out to Aaron, John, James, Eugene, James again, another James, Arthur, Scott, Johannes, Michael, Joseph, Samuel, and Jeremy. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or audio archives or getting a download membership for the website, you help to continue this programming. And I ask that you stop sending your money every month to your cable company, paying the corporate media to lie to you every day, and instead invest in your and everyone else's education by donating and making interviews like these and projects like this happen, but not just here, but for all quality independent media. Support the independent media because it's all we really have to get important information out to one another. Upcoming shows, next week we're going to have Mark Passio back for part two. I also plan to have Miguel Connor on soon to discuss his new book on the Gnostics, as well as Peter Gorman to discuss his book on ayahuasca. I also have Professor John Bolender of Princeton lined up to discuss his new book, The Self-Organizing Social Mind, and Professor Scott Olson from the Wooden Book Series on the Quadrivium. He wrote the section on the Golden Ratio, and he will be here to discuss the Golden Ratio. And also Jason Martineau, distant cousin to our recent guest John Martineau of Wooden Books, here to discuss the spiritual dimension of music. And once again, you can support this program by going to the Gnostic Media website and ordering one of the books or DVDs or the She Who Remembers audio archives, a download membership, a t-shirt, etc. We greatly appreciate your support. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website, GnosticMedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C Media.com. And you can contact me through the contact form on the website or contact me directly at contact@GnosticMedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Mark Passio. Mark, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. How are you doing today?
Jan, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And, you know, for about the last year, many people have contacted me and told me to have you on the show and told me to check out your work. And they always tell me how similar our research is and how much it overlaps. And you had contacted me back, oh, I suppose 6 months ago or so to participate in a convention that you're putting on out in Philadelphia. So I figured since that convention is going to be coming up here in April, that now would be a good time to have you on the show and to figure out what all the hubbub is about that everyone keeps talking about between us.
Fantastic. Definitely. Well, what I contacted you about, we'll let the listening audience know. It's called the Free Your Mind Conference, and it's a conference on consciousness, mind control, and the occult. And that's coming up right here in the city of Philadelphia on April 9th and 10th. That's Saturday, April 9th, and Sunday, April 10th, in Philadelphia in the Northern Liberties section of the city at a venue called Ruba Hall. And Ruba is at 414 Green Street. And it's going to be a two-day conference. We're going to have 16 speakers at the conference, including Jan Ervin and myself. And we're going to probably try to pack in about 200 guests. And we're going to reach people with information that we feel is very relevant in today's times, and hope to elevate consciousness in the local community and around the world in doing so, by presenting topics such as higher consciousness, mind control techniques that are taking place in mass, and present solutions and healing modalities for these types of machinations that are taking place all around us in the modern world.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your educational background, that sort of thing?
Well, I grew up in the city of Philadelphia. I attended the University of Pennsylvania in my, formal left-brained education, I guess you could say, the outcome-based education system that we have here in high schools and universities. But my real educational background comes from my studies in the occult, and I've been initiated into different occult systems in my life. My background is largely, believe it or not, in dark occultism. A lot of the knowledge that I am putting forward into the world comes from my understanding through direct involvement with dark occult orders, what is actually going on in the world and how this knowledge, which is essentially ancient human psychology, is actually being perverted and used as a weapon by people in positions of enormous influence and power in the world. They're using this knowledge, this hidden knowledge, which is essentially what all of the occult is. The occult,
exactly.
Occult just means hidden. That's all it really means. It comes from the Latin verb occultare, which means to hide or to conceal. So it's hidden knowledge, and people with in possession of said knowledge, if they understand what this knowledge is capable of doing, and if they are inclined to do so, To people who have absolutely no idea what this is, because it's basically information of self, about self, and about the deeper aspects of the human consciousness and the psyche. If people who possess this knowledge already are so inclined because of their level of consciousness being low and being fearful and being rooted in base instinct only modalities, if they're obsessed with power and money and wealth and greed and you know, having more at anyone else's expense, they will be inclined to pervert that knowledge and then use it as a weapon against those who know little or nothing of it. And indeed, that is what has happened throughout history and right into the modern age.
How did you get involved in dark occultism research?
It's an interesting story. And, you know, again, it's not something that I'm proud of, yet, as they say, hindsight is 20/20, and I wouldn't trade my former experiences, as dark as they were and as, you know, as low of a place that they plunged me in life, kind of hitting the rock bottom floor of the elevator. I still wouldn't trade those experiences because of what they taught me. So what really led me into that area, those deep, dark recesses of the human consciousness, of the human psyche, was at a young age, I started realizing that the religion that I had been indoctrinated into, which was Christianity, specifically Catholicism, modern organized Catholicism, was fraudulent and was based on essentially a form of control through telling people myths that really weren't accurate or true and getting them to accept dogmatic belief systems based upon those myths. I understood that aspect of organized religion, yet I did not yet understand any of the esoteric sides of it, namely how it was based upon astrotheology. Had I had the knowledge of astrotheology, maybe my life would have taken a very different course in my past. What my hatred for religion upon understanding how it was based upon lies, what that hatred, the route that that hatred took me down was to attempt to find something that was the complete antithesis of that religion. So in doing so, I got involved in Satanism. I wanted to find that whatever was the complete opposite of what I had been lied to about, and that hatred fueled that, the hatred of being lied to, that developed as a result of knowing that I was lied to. So what I eventually stumbled across was LaVey's Satanic Bible, Anton LaVey, high priest, former high priest of the Church of Satan in San Francisco. LaVey, some people think, is like a charlatan or a carny type individual, but let me assure people that the brand of Satanism that he teaches and puts out there is actually the ideology of the elite, is actually the ideology of the psychopaths that are really running the show here and are, you know, running all of the modern depraved and immoral institutions that have basically risen up and taken the types of draconian control that they have and that they now have over just about every aspect of our life, unfortunately. Not to say that LaVey was any kind of a really higher up in that pecking order whatsoever. As a matter of fact, learning what his real role was later, I realized he was simply a lapdog for these much, much higher level dark occultists and pretty much did their bidding. However, basically, to go back to my background in this, the ideology appealed to me then because of my low level of consciousness. I wanted influence over others. I wanted power. I wanted to have as much as possible at anyone else's expense. That was really the mindset that I existed in back in my youth. I wasn't a very good person. I wasn't a very nice person. I was a selfish person, and I'm man enough to admit that now. My level of consciousness was quite low. I was probably easily influenced by appeals to my base instincts. And that is what Satanism really held as a promise. And It's a very it's a system that a lot of people really don't understand how it works, that it basically appeals to those low-level base instincts in people, and it's looking for intelligent, well-articulated people. It's looking for people who don't have strong family connections, and there's deep psychological profiles that are actually worked up on beginning initiates to this who show promise and who show the types of tendencies or personality traits that they are actually looking for to then filtrate upward into the higher orders of the system. And then from my understanding, they begin to filter those people who they consider psychopathic into think tank organizations and other higher level occult organizations that are connected in these satanic networks. And that is all the Church of Satan, which is what I eventually became a priest in. I was actually appointed a priest in the Church of Satan by Anton LaVey himself while he was still alive, actually only about 3 years prior to his death, I believe it was. And they're looking for people with these specific personality traits that they can then groom to bring up higher into that pecking order of dark occultism. And I went as far as becoming a priest, a member of the priesthood of the Church of Satan. I had ties to the Temple of Set, to the Order of the Evil Eye, to other dark occult orders in the Pennsylvania region and in the region around the Philadelphia area, which is where I'm from. And once I started really to understand that it was something that was really a very controlled hierarchical thing that was controlled by top level rich super, I'm talking about the super rich elitists, not people who are just well to do in your average society in a city, let's say. I'm talking about people who are at the top of institutionalized bodies, top level banking, top level military, top level religion, etc. When I started understanding who was really involved at these higher levels, I began to realize this was all about control. Not just control of people outside of these orders, but control of their own membership. And it's a form of mind control. It's appealing to base instincts for some sort of a reward if you fall in line with an agenda is a form of mind control. And when I started to understand that, I guess you could say conscience began to awaken in me. And I realized I'm on the wrong path in life here. I'm helping really depraved, truly psychopathic individuals enact an agenda that I am not really even fully privy to or aware of. And therefore, I started reversing my course and started to back out of it slowly but surely until I learned so much about really what was going on and the interconnectedness of these different orders that I started to speak out on it and then help to explain to people what their actual methodologies were in controlling the human mind and how multifaceted those methodologies are, and then to propose solutions to coming out of that that level of mind control, which really is enacted in mass. It's through the media, it's through the education system, it's through just about every aspect of our lives, when it comes to health and food, anything we read or watch or take into ourselves in any way. And that's what I've been doing ever since, trying to basically turn around from the former dark ways that I lived for many years, probably from my teens into my late 20s, and finally beginning to come out of that in my late 20s until the modern day, when I've been doing the type of work that I've been doing now for probably about, I guess, since about 2006. So, going on 5 years now.
What are the mind control methodologies?
Well, there's tons of them, actually. In my presentation, which I called What on Earth is Happening, and that's the name of my website, whatonearthishappening.com. I have a radio show also called that, which I do every Tuesday night. I actually outlined 14 different methodologies of mind control. And there are many more. It's not in any way to say that these are the only 14. They're the 14 that I identified as probably being the most necessary to understand, because I think they're the most influential over the control of mass consciousness. So I'll list them briefly, and if you want to talk about anyone in particular, we can jump into that in detail. But here's the list that I have come up with, and again, these are, is not to say that this is in any way complete or comprehensive. They're the ones I consider the most important. The first is obfuscation, which is just basic confusion of one thing for another. Okay, it's like a smoke and mirrors game, so to speak. The second is worldview poisoning, which is basically conditioning the way that people view human nature and their own self-value. Okay, the third is the exploitation of primal fears. There are really ancient primal fears that date back to human antiquity that are really nested into the subconscious mind because of the ways our ancestors lived and some of the fears that they developed in our ancient past, you know, as a species. And those fears are exploited in very subtle ways. So the exploitation of primal fears was number three. Number four is a big one, and it's one that a lot of people do know about to some extent, and it's the divide and conquer strategy, which is basically highlighting any perceived differences between people and then exploiting those differences to a point where you can create infighting between different groups of people in order to weaken people as a whole, and then they're easier to come in and control and eventually conquer. The fifth method is the indoctrination of what we call the education system in this country, which is a left brain form of indoctrination and outcome-based education that was championed by the communists during the Bolshevik Revolution and then eventually adapted by the Nazis as part of what was called mastery learning. And that is what really comes down to us in the modern high school, in the modern grade school, high school, and university education system, in a system of left brain indoctrination techniques. So that's number five. Number six was controlled opposition, which is basic dialectics, dialectical mechanics, or what some people might refer to as Hegelianism. This is basically creating conflict that you already have an outcome management system for. You have an outcome management system for said conflict. So you're going to create the conflict and wait for a type of a reaction to that conflict, which is usually a chaotic one or one that demands a resolution to that conflict. Then you're going to step forward as the resolver of said conflict. And this is done in the political system. It's done through the media. It's done through religion. It's basically artificial conflict resolution. That's what controlled opposition or dialectics is all about. The seventh method is one that everybody is aware of, yet few people have any sort of formal remedies for, and that's the monetary system or the financial system of control, which is debt-based, fiat currency-based, fractional reserve banking, this system of illusion that has been built up that we call money, which never has been real, isn't real now, never will be real, yet people believe in it as if it's a religion or a god, you know, that controls every aspect of their life and that they could never live without. This is one of the biggest monolithic aspects of the control system, and yet it's the one that people seem to be the most powerless to come out of, largely because it is entirely constructural in the mind. It exists purely in the mind, and the value of so-called money in today's world is only the value that we ascribe to it through our belief in it. So that's mind control method number seven that I cover. Number eight is the control of the mass media. So if you can control the information that people get to see, hear, read, you basically control their perceptions over what they consider reality. If you limit the scope of what they can take in to their minds and into their awareness, you basically limit the possibilities that they can put forward as far as solutions go, or even limiting their ability to think of anything in a different light. You're limiting the human imagination through controlling what people take into their eyes and ears. So the control of the mass media plays a gigantic role in that. It's human perception management. So that was technique number 8. Technique number 9 I call food and medicine in quotation marks, because the attack on the physical aspects of the body, they basically relate to how our brain development goes. And as you affect brain development through what people take into their bodies, through nutrition, you affect thought and consciousness. The old adage, you are what you eat, is quite literally true. These are the building blocks that comprise the physiology and the makeup of our brain, and therefore how the brain functions, and therefore it directly affects human behavior. The same can be said for drugs. Any kind of pharmacopoeia that we take in through pills, medicines, any kind of treatments in the modern medical world, these are all things that actually affect the whole holistic consciousness. And if they can use techniques that are damaging overall to the consciousness, it's another effective form of control through the modern medical system. The tenth method is called the illusion of time. This is a rather abstract one, but it's one that I think is extremely important for people to grasp. Essentially, this is playing on people's seeming inability to live in the true present moment, in the state of true present moment awareness. It's getting people to live in a state of either regret over the past or anxiety over. This is a fear-based technique. Okay, the past does not exist. It's gone.
Anxiety over what? You cut out for just a second.
Anxiety over what has already occurred in the past, or regret for what has already occurred in the past, or anxiety for what may occur in the future. This takes us out of what is called true present moment awareness, or being in the now, dealing with what is actually before us in the real world, right here and now, and being fully present to take on whatever maybe at hand to look at and deal with. And if they can, if our consciousness can be manipulated into always looking at what already happened, that we don't have any control to go back and undo in the past, because that moment in time is over, or constantly worrying about what might be and what may come. Okay, it takes away effectiveness from dealing with what the current situation at hand right now actually is, and makes people less effective in dealing with present moment, present day issues and problems. So this one kind of is, again, it's an abstract one. It's one that you have to understand there is no other moment of time. There is only the now, and what we do in the present will actually determine the quality of our experience in the future. The 11th method is I've kind of coined this little term, I call it the DHR factor. And this is the threefold factor of basically what other people perceive about you, okay? The denial, hassle, ridicule factor, okay? Denial is staying in a state of cognitive dissonance, or the denial of reality. Okay. In other words, lying to oneself to make oneself feel good about a situation that isn't necessarily good in any way, just because other people ignore it. Okay, I'm going to just stay in this state of ignoring reality, of not actually accepting that which is, but thinking that things are fine the way that they are. I don't want to rock the boat or anything, because then I might have to deal with the next aspect of this little nasty trinity here called hassle. Hassle is where other people give you problems for the way, or flack for the way you may think or feel about a situation, or things that you may do differently than them, or you know, things that you may do that rocks the boat in their system. So people will tend to stay in what is called the hassle-free zone. I don't want all of the uncomfortable aspects of life that may come with standing up for truth or morality or espousing true human freedom. I would rather stay in the hassle-free zone, because then at least I'll be left alone by other people and I won't rock the boat to a point where I draw attention to myself. Again, these things are all fear-based. Denial is fear-based. It's fear of actually taking the responsibility to deal with what's happening in the present moment and what's going on around you. Hassle is the fear of what others may do to you if you start doing something different or start opposing things that you aren't morally okay with. Okay, and then the third aspect of this is ridicule. The ridicule factor is you don't want to deal with what other people's perceptions of you may be. You're fearful of what other people may think of you. So that's the 11th technique, the denial, hassle, ridicule factor, heightening those three forms of mental instability, which is what they all really ultimately boil down to, and trying to keep people in that trap of inactivity and not really doing anything to make things better. The 12th, 13th, and 14th, the last three methods, are the ones I tend to spend the most time on and attribute the most importance to because of how powerful of a hold they can have over the human psyche. Now, of course, the financial system is a really big one, and I don't downplay the significance of that one in all these 14, but I attribute the last three, I call those the big guns. These are the ones that really I feel have the tightest hold and over the human mind, and really are the ones that we need to understand as much, if not better, than all the others if we're really going to come out of this form of control. And the first of these last three is religion. And I know that this is something that you've spent an enormous amount of time and effort and scholarly work exposing. And I talk about religion as a form of binding, because the word religion actually comes from the Latin language and it means to tie back. Religare is a word that means to tie back. Re means back or again in Latin, and legeo, legere is to tie or to bind. So religion is tying back. Now, in a sense, forms of modern-day religion are mind control based upon astrotheology. And I know, as your listeners are well aware of, you've done an enormous amount of work exposing astrotheology as it relates to religion and religious traditions. I focus on that in my work as well. And there's a lot of overlap there. And, this is a form of binding when it comes to how religion is used. It's giving people an exoteric version of something that was once an esoteric mystery that was related to the self and to consciousness. So if you can get them focusing on the external or the exoteric aspects, you really have them under a form of control, because they're not really looking inward and dealing with the esoteric or the actual deep core of the seed of truth that lies at the heart of really all the religious traditions, what they were ultimately unified about, not what they were divided about and warring over. Okay, but so there can be a positive side to the word religion, or what the original essence of religion was intended to be, and that means to rebind to the truth or to natural law, to make a reconnection with self, with higher self. And that is a positive aspect of the word. It can mean, as with symbolism, words can take on dual meanings depending on how you look at it and what the original intent is. I believe that religion in the modern world has become true binding as a form of mind control that basically binds the left brain or logical hemisphere, the masculine hemisphere of the brain, and puts too much of an overemphasis on the right brain, sacred feminine side of the brain, that leads to actually wanting to be controlled or wanting to be enslaved in a form. Government is the opposite of that. It is the binding upon the right brain through left brain masculine control-based modalities of consciousness. So these two forms of control, government and religion, are two sides of the arch that leans against each other for tremendous support. They're two forms of mind control that go to work on the two different hemispheres of the human brain. So that's the 12th method. The 13th one, again, this is one of the what I kind of call the unholy trinity, or the three big guns of mind control, is the use of subversive symbolism that is basically based in ancient sacred symbolism. And this is all over the modern world. It's a language unto itself. It is based in symbols that have been with us from antiquity. It is religious symbolism. It is a symbolism that employs solar symbolism. Of course, this is one of their favorites. Life force symbolism, symbolism that is based upon energy and blood and just in general things that we need for existence and life. And they use these different archetypal energies, these archetypal forms in modern symbolism, whether it be for symbolism for an institution, symbolism for advertising, you name it, police, military, banking institutions, media corporations, stores, every aspect of our life. We are in just completely symbolism is omnipresent. It's everywhere. We're surrounded by it. We're drenched in it practically because people who are attempting to influence people's minds and their behavior patterns and their buying patterns know how powerful of a subconscious psychic influence basic symbols are. And they know that those symbols speak to the human subconscious. And if they understand what those symbols say, the language that they basically speak to the subconscious, they can speak to us without words, wordlessly. And they can embed things subliminally through these symbols that we don't even understand what they're saying. Okay, so it's a wordless form of communication, and an ancient one at that. And this is what I've been spending the bulk of my time recently on my radio show discussing and delving into many different forms of symbolism. And that connects with different occult traditions as well, because occult traditions are laden with symbolism as well. And, you know, as a tie-in to looking into different forms of subversive symbolism as they are used in the modern world through advertising, media, governmental institutions and networks, etc. I've kind of been doing a crossover into discussing different occult traditions like that really heavily employ symbolism, like Kabbalah, Tarot, Freemasonry, etc. So that's technique number 13, and the final technique that I cover, at least. We could discuss others, but this is, again, these are the out of the 14 that I cover and consider significant. The 14th and final one, many people have given it different names. It's been called problem reaction solution. I like to call this one chaos sorcery. Okay, people have called it chaos magic, but I like the word sorcery in place of magic because I tend to make a distinction between these two forms of influence. I call this chaos sorcery because what this is a mass demonstration, okay, or a public display of the dark aspects of the Hegelian dialectic. Okay, the Hegelian dialectic has two sides to it. It could be used as a weapon. It could be used in a positive sense. But when you look at Hegelianism and dialectical mechanics, and you look at how this concept is employed on mass scales in public daylight, so to speak, right in the light of day, okay, there's this technique that comes up over and over again, and I call it chaos sorcery. Now, what other people have just traditionally referred to this as is false flag terrorism, which I'm sure is a phrase that a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. I tend to make a little bit more of a distinction, because I feel that this is ritual magic that is being used openly in the light of day, regardless of who's doing it. What you're doing is you're creating a chaotic situation in the light of day that you are well aware of that it's being created because you're doing it, and you know that the situation that you're creating is going to elicit an extreme reaction of fear, and it's going to be a chaotic reaction that demands order be brought to that situation as quickly as possible. In doing so, what you're doing is manipulating the human fear-based functions of the brain, which are in the limbic system, and people who think through the limbic system are simply reacting emotionally. They're not really reasoning. They're not in a state that they can reason because the limbic brain has turned on to a point where it's really has taken over, and they're demanding solutions purely out of emotions. So the person's not in a reasonable state of mind, not in a high level of consciousness. They're in a reactive mode of consciousness, and that creates the perfect opportunity for the manipulator who created this situation in the first place to step in with a predetermined solution. See, controllers, dominators, psychopaths, they want the outcome of the game known before the game has even begun to be played. So that's what this form of chaos sorcery is about. It's about interjecting chaos into a situation, and you know the reaction it's going to cause, and therefore you know how what the reaction is going to be like when you step forward and propose the solution. You know that it will be accepted, provided that there is no leap in consciousness or mass understanding of the technique that's being employed, which is why you always have to carry it out in a covert fashion under a cloak of darkness, never in the light of day where it can be seen for what it is. And this technique, sadly, seems to work over and over and over again in human history, and as yet, humanity has not in mass awoken to how this tactic is deployed and used as a method of mass control. And 9/11, of course, was the prime example in the modern in modern times of what I term chaos sorcery, which is the 14th and final method of manipulation. So there's my breakdown, Jan. That's what I've been covering on my show for many, many weeks, and will continue to do so for several more. When I exhaust these methods of mind control, then I will be going into the positive side. Of course, you know, this is the negative aspect, and it's important to know about. Yes, it's negative. Yes, it's you know, really being used as weaponry against us. And no, not many people are fully aware of all of these techniques, but that's the whole point. We need to make them aware of them by speaking them and helping people to understand them and laying them out in a logical progression so that people can become streetwise to them, you might say, so that when they are brought out, they can see them for what they are. They can see the truth of these techniques for what they are and how they are used to manipulate people and basically used as a form of mind control. So after I finish laying out all of these and going through them all on my radio show, I will be then delving into deep introspective solutions that we can all really employ and that we could all employ to one extent or another in our lives to get out of these techniques and to get out of these forms of mind control and to really take back control over our own minds, our own thinking, and ultimately our own destiny. So that's my breakdown of what I call the 14 methods of manipulation, or the 14 forms of mind control that are actively employed against us.
Well, very interesting stuff there, Mark. And you might be interested to know, and I know you and I talked about this briefly last night, and I know you've heard of it, but a lot of what you're covering, except for money, food and medicine, and time,
right,
are all covered under the trivium, grammar, right, logic, and rhetoric. And so what you have with obfuscation, confusion, worldview poisoning, primal fears, you know, primal fears would be appeal to fear fallacies, divide and conquer strategies, false dilemma strategies, indoctrination of education. Since the 1850s, they've pretty much effectively removed all of the classical and trivium, quadrivium education out of,
yes,
our education system.
Absolutely.
And then you go into the DHR factor, denial, hassle, ridicule. Those are all appeal to fear, appeal to ridicule, and ad baculum. Those are all fall under the fallacies. The religion falls under appeal to belief, circular reasoning, and another one that does not fall under that is subversive symbolism. Symbolism is a whole, I've studied symbolism extensively myself.
Sure.
And that's a whole different issue that's not covered in that. And then problem, reaction, solution would also be covered under the trivium, the Hegelian dialectic, excluding, obviously you would be able to define it more and then focus more on the chaos sorcery and the mass demonstration and false flags and things like that.
Yes.
So, I think maybe this is why so many people, because I can see how this stuff does indeed fit together between the work that you and I have been doing.
Absolutely.
Less the entheogens or psychedelics.
You could see if you take out those three basic methodologies for learning and the order that they're employed in, the result are people who are incapable of seeing these methodologies for what they are. They actually, it's an amputation of the ability to see patterns in the world as they actually are and the meaning of those patterns with respect to one's own life. That's essentially what they're doing. And it's brilliant. You have to concede that it is a brilliant strategy. Yet the trivium and quadrivium could be effective tools in combating these forms of mind control and helping to help us to generate a new class of people that are immune to these techniques.
And that's exactly what we've been attempting to do through my show. And in fact, Bob Tuscan just had Gino Denning on his show last night. And Gene is the one who brought us the trivium and quadrivium about a year and a half ago through my show. And it is exactly that. It's not, it could be, but it is literally a system for, it's a mental antivirus system, but it's a functioning system for how the human mind works and catching as much of that type of stuff coming in as possible. And grammar or knowledge is like the parts of an engine. And as you're taking in information, you're looking at these things and you say, these are all the parts that I'm dealing with, whether you're dealing with language and letters and words, or if you're dealing with things out in the environment like the parts to a car engine. And then the grammar aspect is knowledge, and then you go into logic, and logic is understanding, and that would be like the engine put together and working properly. And you have a knowledge, all of the contradictions have been removed. You have a knowledge of what's there. You've got it together. It's working. So you can't have understanding before you have knowledge of what's there.
Yeah, there's an order there. Exactly.
Right. And then the next stage is rhetoric or wisdom. And that would be like the instruction manual to the engine, right?
Application of the knowledge.
Well, it would be expressing exactly how the engine was put together. It would be like a Chilton's manual or something for how to work on a car. And so it would give you all of those details of how it all goes together. And that's the rhetoric aspect or sharing that information with others, which is wisdom.
That's
and
right.
So all of the under, you know, all of this falls under the logic aspects, like all of the logical fallacies, and there's no complete list. There's 22 to 42 primary fallacies that are used, and once you take these fallacies and are able to put a name to them, you take them from implicit knowledge to explicit knowledge. So then you can say, aha, now I have a name for that lie, which is basically what you've done with your 14 things here, is you've created names for them so that you can identify them.
Sure.
And so all of these fallacies, when you have this explicit knowledge when somebody lies to you, then you're able to say, ah, this person just used an ad hominem or a red herring, appeal right. to belief, exactly. Et cetera. And so that moves, instead of just having that, you know, funny feeling or whatever, and you've done an exceptional job and creating your own identification of how they work. And so once it goes from implicit to explicit knowledge, though, it severs you from that control.
Exactly.
There's formal and informal fallacies. The informal fallacies are used typically in speech, but they can also be used in writing. But there's formal fallacies which show you how even the structuring of a sentence, the subject and predicate of a sentence and everything, if that is not correct, then the statement is false and you can throw it out. So these are tools to learn explicitly how people are lying and manipulating to you. And so the entire idea is creating this meme so that we can give that knowledge back to people so that they can begin to see through the smoke and mirrors.
And that's what it's really all ultimately about. I stress over and over again on my show that knowing is only the very beginning of the process, of this process of healing that we're attempting to effect. Actually getting out into the world and taking action and then spreading that knowledge, okay, through your community, through your family and friends, to the people that you know. Putting back out into the world what you have taken in into your own makeup and your own self is the main important part of what we all need to do here. I often say a phrase, I don't believe I'm the person who coined it, but I really like the power of it because it shows us how we're really a holistic part of the entire universe in which we live. And that is, this saying is, the universe is spoken into existence. Okay? So we need to be a reflection of that, of the power of the voice, of the word, and speak the truth back into the field of which we are a part of. It's been said that history rewards those with the strongest voice, okay? Actually speaking, the knowledge that we have taken in back into the world around us is what wisdom really ultimately is. It's taking action through what we already know and the knowledge that we have gathered and the knowledge we have taken into ourselves and made part of ourselves. That's only the first step. Putting it back out to complete that cycle is just as important as the process of initially taking it into ourselves to improve ourselves. It then has to be put back out there for others to do the same with.
What can you tell us about the Sun Saviors?
Throughout history, the same repeating story of a son of God who has magical capabilities, who is has 12 helpers, who has can perform miracles, who dies upon a cross usually, who is resurrected usually after a period of 3 days, who does battle with a dark evil enemy, is you know, kind of killed or conquered, and then rises from the dead. Is told over and over and over and over and over again throughout human history and even prehistory. This story is ancient. It predates all modern Christianity. Christianity is another rework of it. Actually, if you look into the exoteric Christian religion, which is about this Sun Savior story, what you find is that it is a simple retelling of the Sun Savior myth that was told during the Roman Empire, the story of Sol Invictus. Sol Invictus is the god that Constantine worshipped as Roman emperor. He saw in the early turn of the third, or what was it, the fourth century, that the Roman Empire began to deteriorate into chaos because of the types of religious and political and cultural infighting that was taking place throughout the empire. He wanted to unify that and realized he would not probably be able to do it politically, but if he did it religiously, there would be much tighter bonds forged throughout the Roman Empire. So he chose Christianity, which was an upcoming esoteric religion during that time period that was based on teachings about morality. Okay? And this was the Gnostic tradition, not what we call the Christian tradition today, which has become a perversion of that original teaching and has become a dogmatic religion based on the dictates of Constantine after convening the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century, and at the point of violence really did that. People think it was a fair and dignified council. It was nothing of the kind. It was basically held under essentially threat or penalty of death if he didn't really agree with what was practically agreed in advance the religion would be. He deified this sun savior, which was just another account, another retelling of the story of Sol Invictus. This sun story goes back into the ancient world. I mean, you look at the story of Gilgamesh, you look at the story of Nimrod, of Tammuz in the Babylonian and Sumerian periods. You look at Osiris and Horus in the Egyptian time frame. You go to the myths of Mithra and Dionysus in the Roman periods. You can go on and on and on, on and on. You can go on. I could lay out 30 or 40 names. You know, Quetzalcoatl in the Mesoamerican tradition, and you know, on and on from there. Zoroaster. They're all telling the same basic story. Well, in the Roman tradition, it was Sol Invictus, so Constantine grafted that story of the Sun Savior onto the cosmic Christ or the Gnostic Christ, which was this Savior consciousness, this higher level of consciousness that the Gnostics originally spoke of. And he basically used that as a unifying glue for the different satellite nations of the Roman Empire and unified the empire under one religion, and it was a form of control. People say that Constantine repented on his deathbed and became Christian. He did really nothing of the sort. I consider that was a hearsay account, and it was done simply to give more credence to this new unifying religion so that it would spread faster and people would be able to gather it under the banner of law and political control at an even quicker rate. I feel that he died pagan on his deathbed and made no such conversion to this new religion, which in fact was simply his old religion. You know, and people think that they're worshiping something different in the modern form when they, you know, attend modern day Christianity, regardless of what sect or
denomination.
Denomination it is. Thank you. It's really this the retelling of the same old sun savior myth that comes out of the ancient world, and as all religion is based upon astrotheology. I mean, this is just the solar sect of astrotheology. The other two major sects, which was the lunar cult. The lunar cult was given to the religion Islam, or I should say Islam as a religion was given to the lunar cult. It's the modern incarnation of the lunar cult. And Judaism comes down to us out of the ancient world as the ancient stellar cults, or the cult of the stars and the planets. It's all about astrotheology and the worship.
Isn't it related more to Jupiter and Saturn?
Saturn being a planet, so it's a stellar and planetary form of astrotheology, and the main planet, or what they considered the king of the planets, was Saturn. Therefore, their Sabbath day is on Saturday, or Saturn's day, just like Christians worship on Sunday, the sun's day. And the Muslim religion Sabbath is on Friday, which is Freya. In the exactly. Norse tradition, the goddess Freya, it's the goddess's day. In the French religion.
That's Venus, isn't it?
Venus,
Freya?
Yes, the goddess, exactly. And again, the goddess is connected with Isis, or the moon goddess in the ancient Egyptian pantheon of gods and goddesses. And that's where the Islamic religion is largely based out of, the feminine lunar cult of the ancient world. All astrotheological religious cults based on the same basic retellings of these stories. Now, part of my work is helping people to understand that while these religions are re-scripted to basically be an exoteric retelling of these stories, there is, as a matter of fact, a very deep esoteric aspect to astrotheological worldview. And this is how these religions are perversions of that that come down to us into the modern world. If we go back far enough and go back to the original mystery traditions from which a lot of these teachings are derived, we understand that these things that were being looked at and revered, I don't even want to use the word worshipped, were not external things in the sky. They were not the actual lights of the heavens, okay? These were only symbols that represented aspects of the self, okay? For example, the moon was a symbol that represented the sacred feminine aspects of creativity, nurturing, true care, okay? Bonding, all right? Intuition, the passive nature of one's self, or the passive sides to the personality, okay, restfulness, etc. They're all feminine qualities, and they were all internal qualities, okay, and they all have to do with the emotional maturity of the person, the emotional aspects, and that's what they were revering, not really the moon specifically as an actual object, okay. Unfortunately, these religions come down to us and are sort of worship of these actual objects. You know, they are watered down versions of these original mystery traditions that were ultimately about the self and aspects within the self. And sadly, they've been watered down, perverted, and sold in an exoteric fashion. You know, something that's reserved for the unwashed masses, given to the unwashed masses, while the deep mystery traditions aspects of it are reserved for an inner core elite, you know, or a select group, you know, or an elect group, as the case may be. Look at Judaism. Okay, these are all the intellectual aspects, or the mental qualities, and understanding how to break things down and to analyze, okay, and to look deeper into things and get to the core of the matter. Okay, these are about the quality of our thoughts. If you really study the deep aspects of the Kabbalistic religion, it's about understanding man's relationship to the cosmos and natural law. And it was originally something that was intended to be good. Now, of course, as we've already talked about, for every positive aspect of the occult, there is its mirror opposite. There's the dark occult. And that can be perverted and twisted and used as a weapon for the people so inclined to do so, and they have done that. So there's dark Kabbalism. You know, there's dark Masonry. There's dark Rosicrucianism. Every positive aspect of the occult can be taken and twisted, and it can be, you know, its counter aspect, its counter essence can be set up. And indeed it has been, not just can be, that actually has been done. And that's really these high-level occultists that understand this knowledge and how it's all related to the inner qualities of the self and the human psyche. They're the ones who have set up these methods of mind control that we've already spoken about. We look at the Christian religion. It's not about the actual sun or even this figure or personage, you know, that is attributed to being Jesus, you know. Whether that's an actual historical personage or not, I even almost stay away from that one. I know there's a lot of evidence to the contrary that it may not have actually been a historical personage. I have a difficult time thinking that something that big could have simply been created without some foundational basis for a teacher or a group of teachers. Now, maybe there was a group of Gnostic teachers that studied the mystery traditions and were carrying that knowledge, and they termed it, you know, Gnosticism or original Gnostic Christianity back then, and looked at this as a form of consciousness that was being taught and was being brought to people. And that's another reason Constantine had to shut it down. If that higher form of consciousness or Christ consciousness had reached the masses of people, there's no way they would have saw through all of the control that was being enacted upon them by the Roman Empire and their political system of basically serfdom. They would have saw through it in an instant. Which is what we're trying to affect. We're trying to raise consciousness to that high cosmic level so that people cut through all the forms of BS mind control and can see the truth for what it is, staring them in the face, telling them to wake up. But Christianity was about this higher level of consciousness, the original esoteric form of it. And the symbol of the sun always represented that. It represented illumination and awakening and awareness and understanding and awakening to one's the nature of one's true self and what reality really was all about. And that's what the symbol of the sun has always depicted. And it's another reason why they love to use it as symbolism, as subversive symbolism, to get you to buy things or buy into ideas. Because the sun's powerfully used in those capacities, because they're always using it to try to sell you on something that they know you want and don't have. And most people don't have that level of consciousness or enlightenment. And so they sell them on the symbol as a proxy. And then they associate that symbol with an idea or a product, you know, or a service. And then lo and behold, people flock to it because it's something that's appealing to them, that they understand in wordless archetypal forms. Represents an idea that is held in the subconscious mind, whether they're consciously aware of it or not. So, you know, all of these external, exoteric forms that we look at in astrotheology, it's important to understand those astrotheological underpinnings of religion, but we can't stop there. I think we have to go even beyond that and understand that originally these represented internal qualities of the self that we have to reconnect with. And understand that if we go down completely past that exoteric shell, we can get down to that esoteric core and even past that and go right to the heart or the bullseye of the mystery. And that's what ultimately we're really trying to get to. And that's called the truth.
Discuss natural law.
Okay. Well, this is a big one, and it's something I talk about a lot on my show and in my presentations. What natural law is what natural means is self-existing or inherent. It means that it's operating whether we accept it, whether we believe in it or not, okay? It's something that simply exists. We didn't create it. It's not created by man, okay? It simply exists. It's of nature. Okay, law is something that is binding. It's conditions that are binding regardless of whether you believe in them. Okay, so it's like, let's look at gravity as an example of law. And indeed, it's natural law. Okay, it's a law of nature. You don't need to believe in gravity for it to be in effect in a three-dimensional space-time continuum where there is mass present. Okay, it is in effect. You don't need to believe in it. You don't need to accept it. You don't even need to understand how it works. In other words, if you're in a gravitational field, gravity is operating. It's something that exists inherently in that and under those conditions, and that you are bound by whether you like it or not. Now, that applies to a physical natural law. There is natural law that applies to the non-physical world, okay, or the realm of behaviors and the realm of actions. Okay. Now, yes, actions are taken in the physical world, but what I mean is the repercussions of those actions in daily experience. Now, people have called this many different things. Some people have referred to this as karmic law. Some people have referred to this as the law of cause and effect. Some people have referred to this as the law of attraction, and it is all of those things. Okay. It is what happens upon action, upon taking action, that then becomes the quality of our experience. It dictates the quality of our experience, I should say. Okay? So this is entirely based on whether the action is taken in alignment with truth and in alignment with morality, or that which is right. Okay? Now, that which is right and that which is true, we use terms and words, and the meanings of these terms and words, sometimes they're so simple that they escape our attention. When we say something is true and we say something is right, those two words can be used interchangeably. Okay? If you say 2 plus 2 equals 4, we say, yes, that's true. 2 plus 2 equals 4, that's right. That which is based in truth, in actual point of fact truth, okay? And there is such a thing. This is